It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The 17-nation International Syria Support Group meeting Tuesday in Vienna was unable to set a date for resumption of talks on Syria's political future. Although U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said the commitment to seeing a 2-month cessation of hostilities remain intact and violations of an end remains firm.
None of us, no one, can be remotely satisfied with the situation in Syria. It's deeply disturbing, and we are all concerned about the levels of violence that broke out in recent days challenging the cessation. Russia has worked closely with the United States to upgrade our ability, which now has a 24-hour basis in Geneva with high-level people working consistently.
Kerry insisted the international community has leverage and that the 5-year conflict has no military solution and that why it needs a political settlement. He said the group agreed that if a party to the ceasefire persistently violates the truce, that they could be excluded from the agreement. Kerry also said beginning June 1st, if relief workers are denied humanitarian access, the World Food Program would make arrangements to accelerate airdrops and regular flights into besieged areas. Nigerian labor union and civil society groups appear prepared to stage a strike Wednesday over increased gasoline prices, despite a court-issued injunction that they not take such action. Talks between the government and the Nigeria Labor Congress and the Trade Union Congress broke down late Tuesday after the ruling handed down by the country's industrial court. The strike is over a nearly 70% increase in gasoline prices, prompted by the removal of a government subsidy on gas in a bid to curb an ongoing fuel shortage exacerbated by a foreign exchange crisis. This is VOA News. A wave of bombing struck markets across Iraq's capital Tuesday, killing nearly 70, wounding dozens more. It brings to nearly 200 the number of people killed in the past week. U.S. spokesman John Kirby condemned the latest attacks.
These attacks are the latest reminder of the danger that this group continues to pose to all Iraqis and the importance of Iraqi leaders from all communities to continue to work together so that progress against Daesh can continue to be made. It's a very serious threat still in the country.
There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but Islamic State militants have said they were responsible for deadly bombings in Baghdad last week that killed more than 100. The U.S. Senate has approved legislation that would allow the survivors and relatives of nearly 3,000 people killed in the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks in the U.S. to sue Saudi Arabia's government for damages. It brought expressions of concern from White House spokesman Josh Earnest.
This legislation would change longstanding international law regarding sovereign immunity. The President of the United States continues to harbor serious concerns that this legislation would make the United States vulnerable in other court systems around the world.
Riyadh has denied any involvement in the attacks, the worst terrorism ever in the U.S., but 15 of 19 airline hijackers who commandeered 4 jets to carry out assaults in New York and Washington were identified as Saudi. Kenya's police chief has reportedly ordered an internal investigation a day after riot police were accused of excessive force and breaking up the latest protest outside the Nairobi office of the country's Electoral Commission. U.S. Ambassador Robert Godek issued a statement deploring what he called the excessive use of force by security services and the violence around the demonstrations. Kenya is beginning the process of tearing down poorly constructed buildings following this month's collapse of a high-rise residential apartment that killed more than 50 people. Moses Nyakiongora is a building inspector.
If a building is of questionable structural integrity, we have two things to do. First, if it is salvageable, if it can be reinforced or remedied, it can be done. If it is completely unsalvageable like this one, where engineers have confirmed that it's completely unsafe and there's nothing you can do to make it safer, this one is normally recommended and necessary. Orders have been given to the owner to bring it down.
Kenyan authorities have reportedly located more than 250 such structures considered structurally at risk. In U.S. presidential politics, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton inches toward the number of delegates needed to secure the Democratic Party's nomination. Clinton and her lone rival, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, are each expected to pick up at least 25 delegates from the Kentucky state primary election held Tuesday, where the outcome is considered too close to call. Another primary election took place Tuesday in the western state of Oregon. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 18th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberia's former foreign minister declares his candidacy for the 2017 presidential election.
Over the years, I have contributed to my country. I have acquired the necessary competence, both in leadership positions, out of government, in government. We feel that we can do more at the level of the presidency.
Augustine Gafuan is former foreign minister of Liberia. Experts offered advice to President Robert Mugabe on revitalizing Zimbabwe's ailing economy. A top aid official says Africa's drought may impact up to 49 million people. And an opposition leader calls on Burundi's government to engage all stakeholders ahead of an inter-Burundian dialogue later this month.
One make peace with his enemies, not with his friends. What is the benefit of having that dialogue? And why do we have a dialogue? It is because we have a crisis.
Agathon Rwasa is opposition leader and deputy speaker of Burundi's parliament. The Zika virus is expected to top next week's World Health Organization Assembly in Geneva. And more than half the world's population is still not connected to the internet. Those stories plus Marco Uman's post and our listener of the day is coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberia's former foreign minister, Augustine Gafuan, has declared his candidacy for the 2017 presidential election. He joins a growing list of candidates, including Vice President Joseph Boakai, football legend George Weah, Charles Bromsky of the Liberty Party, and businessman Benigno Ure, former associate of former President Charles Taylor. Gafuan, who also served as finance minister, is touting what he calls his track record of competence and integrity in both public and private leadership capacities.
Over the years, I have contributed to my country. I have acquired the necessary competence, both in leadership positions, out of government, in government, from the central bank, from the position of budget director of the Republic of Liberia, from the position of finance minister, from the position of foreign affairs minister. I have been delivering for my country, and I intend to continue a track record of delivering for my country at the level of the presidency. 2017 is a critical juncture in the history of this country. The challenges of leadership will require that Liberia has its best in terms of law for country, its best in terms of credibility and integrity, is best in terms of competence.
Mr. Gafuan, what is going to be your party affiliation? Are you running as an independent, unity party? What's your affiliation going into the election?
Well, if you follow the news, I have transitioned from the unity party. I will, in the coming days, announce my new political home. But I can tell you, I will not be an independent candidate. Besides party label, we are amassing the necessary forces.
You are from Lofa County, am I right?
Yes, I am.
And the vice president is from Lofa County also. So are you not going to be competing with the vice president?
This is not primarily a county contest. It is a national contest. My county, Lofa, deserves all of its best to be put forward, and that the choices should be left with the Liberian people. So I am not in this competition in opposition to the vice president. I am creating a choice. Ultimately, the judges will be the Liberian voters.
Mr. Gafuan, the topic of corruption is particularly current this week and last week, also given the release of this Global Witness report. Let me give you a chance to comment first on the Global Witness report. What's your own take on the report? What would you do in terms of fighting corruption in Liberia?
Let me say this. The report is very concerning, and I need to commend the president firstly for the initial action. There may be need for more actions. We hope that as the process eventuates, that justice will be served and that the perception of a process that is free, fair, and equitable is protected. Now, concerning what I intend to do with dealing with corruption, the first thing is for leaders to show the example. Look in the mirror and be the change you want. And I can say that over the time, one thing I have and one thing others will tell you about what I bring to the table we bring to the table a track record of credibility. And that is what we intend to institutionalize.
Augustin Gafuan is Liberia's former foreign and finance minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. The inter-Burundian dialogue is set to resume later this month. Main opposition leader Agathon Rwasa has called on the Burundi government to engage with all stakeholders, including the failed coup plotters, in order to defuse the current political crisis. Moses Javier Romana reports from Bujumbura.
Burundi has been hit by a political crisis since last year after incumbent President Pierre Nkurunziza publicly announced he will seek for another term in the office, which the opposition said was unconstitutional. Since then, more than 400 people have been killed and thousands have fled to neighboring countries. As dialogue is seen as the only way out of the crisis, Burundi government said that it will not engage with opposition leaders who participated in the failed coup last year. Agathon Rwasa is the leading opposition leader and currently the deputy speaker at the Burundi parliament.
One make peace with his enemies, not with his friends. What is the benefit of having that dialogue? And why do we have a dialogue? It is because we have a crisis. And among those who are involved in the crisis are those who managed to operate that aborted coup. Why should people think about overthrowing the institutions? So how can you know what was behind that if you cannot sit with them and listen to them?
The Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza had last year formed a dialogue commission that started its activities in the country. The panel consists of 15 members that include religious leaders, political actors, and civil society members. However, opposition leaders who are currently in exile have raised concerns about the membership and the transparency of the dialogue commission. Justin Zoisaba is the chairman of the commission.
I will be there to listen because I am listening Burundians. I hope to see Burundians who are fearing to come in inside Burundi so that they can tell us what they think are the causes of this crisis so that we can gather them, compile the issues.
Last week, ruling party supporters marched in Burundi's capital, calling on the dialogue to be conducted in the country instead of taking place in Arusha. Last year, the inter-Burundi dialogue was conducted in Bujumbura and was suspended more than four times by three different facilitators as impositions were put by both government and the opposition. Agathon Rwasa said that both sides should be tolerant to each other for the benefit of Burundians.
Because I'm convinced that, after all, we are in an electoral crisis and the solution must be an electoral one. But one cannot prepare for election inside when another will be preparing for elections outside. So there is a need to ameliorate, to improve the political environment first, to be able to say that dialogue should be taking place into Burundi.
The dialogue was expected to resume early this month, but was postponed until late this month for further consultations. The mediation will be overseen by former Tanzanian President Benjamin Mkapa. Sources say that further consultations were being done in order to bring all stakeholders on the table in efforts to defuse the current political crisis that has hit the country for more than a year now. Moses Havyarimana, VOA News, Bujumbura.
Today's Wednesday, May 18th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. Some Zimbabweans say President Robert Mugabe's government should embark on key policy shifts, especially on the controversial Black Economic Empowerment Program, which compels foreign-owned companies to part with majority shares in order to revitalize the country's ailing economy. This call comes at a time the International Monetary Fund says Zimbabwe remains in debt distress and should reduce its huge wage bill. Thomas Churipasi of VOA Zimbabwe program reports.
Following the introduction of a controversial land reform program in 2000, Zimbabwe's economy has never shown any meaningful signs of sustained growth, except between 2009 and 2013, under a unity government which adopted multiple currencies like the United States dollar, the South African rand, the Botswana pula, and several others. 16 years after the agrarian reforms were implemented, followed by the country's adoption of the indigenization, some locals like Barnabas Tondlana say Harare now needs to come up with policies that promote foreign direct investment. Tondlana, a newspaper publisher and editor, says the black economic empowerment is one of the current policies that ought to be reversed because it is scaring away potential investors.
For us to revive our industry, we have to look at where did we go wrong, at which point did we go wrong. And we went absolutely wrong on the land issue. So we have to go back to the land issue and see how we can ensure that the people who are on the land, the people who are given those farms, are highly productive.
But Indigenization Minister Patrick Juao is on record saying the government would not backtrack on its indigenization plans that compel foreign-owned businesses to transfer at least 51% of their shares to black Zimbabweans. Tinashe Gumbo, Programs Officer of the Zimbabwe Coalition on Debt and Development, agrees, adding that Zimbabwe should urgently deal with its external debt of nearly $10 billion in order to get fresh lines of credit from international finance institutions like the IMF, World Bank, and others.
We need to know how much we owe and to whom we owe and what was the purpose of those debts when they were actually incurred.
According to Obed Gutu, spokesperson of the MDC formation led by former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai, the government also needs to deal with corruption that has crippled the public and private sectors.
So for as long as we have a government that is inherently and intrinsically corrupt, we should actually expect the debt to balloon.
On the other hand, international money lending institutions have not been giving Zimbabwe any financial assistance, but government says it is working on a debt recovery strategy that may see it getting fresh lines of credit if approved by the IMF, World Bank, and others. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
A top aid official says up to 49 million people may be affected by the ongoing drought in southern Africa, a massive jump from previous estimates. The head of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies says emergency aid is not enough and that aid groups need to also address issues of resilience and infrastructure. Viewers Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Aid officials are sounding the alarm over the severe drought that is hammering southern Africa, saying the crisis is likely to get worse before it improves. The El Niño weather phenomenon began last year and has battered much of southern Africa with severe floods, followed by severe drought. It has affected at least 32 million people, and experts say the numbers are likely to rise.
We're talking about 31.6 million people, and that number may climb to even 49. As we speak, there are a number of assessments, you know, going on, and that's the reason why you'll always hear these fluctuating numbers.
That's Elhaj Assi, Secretary General of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, who just wrapped up a trip to some of the worst affected drought zones in Malawi and Zimbabwe. Assi, a father of five, told VOA he was deeply moved by the people who are experiencing the crisis. Not just by their plight, he said, but by their resilience, optimism, and desire for dignity. He beamed with fatherly pride as he showed us pictures of himself with a little Zimbabwean girl who was clutching a bag of cookies and basking in the limelight of attention. A small spark of joy, he said, amid this crisis. He spoke of the mother who insisted on using part of her meager funds to buy soap so her children could be presentable. And he spoke of the desperation and determination of a young man who spent more than an hour digging in a dried-out riverbed for less than a gallon of water. This week, C announced a $112 million four-year initiative to address the crisis. That effort, he said, will also focus on helping those communities learn to better cope with future shocks. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
World Health Organization Chief Margaret Chan says the Zika virus and other health emergencies will top the organization's annual assembly, which meets next week in Geneva. Lisa Schlein reports.
WHO Director General Margaret Chan says the more that is known about the Zika virus, and particularly its impact on pregnant women, the more worrisome it becomes. Zika currently is circulating in 59 countries, among them Brazil, which is hosting the Summer Olympic Games. While Brazil is in the forefront of the epidemic, Dr. Chan says WHO does not support a travel ban to the Games. She does, however, advise caution, especially for pregnant women who could give birth to babies with brain abnormalities if they become infected with the virus.
Pregnant women should avoid traveling to these places who are reporting local infection. Another important point is men who travel to these countries, including to Olympic, should they be infected when they get home, they must practice safe sex, particularly if their partners or spouse are pregnant. So they need to use condom for the entire duration of the pregnancy.
Chan says many lessons have been learned from the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. But in order to apply these lessons to better contain the spread of newly emerging diseases such as Zika, she says the WHO will ask the Assembly for a budgetary increase of $160 million for the next 2 years. The WHO chief tells VOA there are many other communicable and non-communicable diseases of great concern, with 76 health issues to be considered at the Assembly. The meeting is expected to be the biggest ever, with some 3,100 delegates from the WHO's 194 member countries in attendance. One of the biggest concerns, she says, remains that of maternal mortality.
We still see close to 300,000 women die unnecessarily giving birth. In poor countries, about 1 in 60 chance of women dying from giving birth, 1 in 60. In wealthy countries, 1 in 4,900. This is huge inequity.
Chan says sexual reproductive health must be made accessible to young people so they have the ability to make the sexual and family planning choices that are right for them. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The World Bank says while there are 9 billion devices connected to the Internet as of today, more than half the world's population is still not able to access information online. Many of those who have no Internet access live in developing countries. Technologists and government officials say getting connected is critical to improving the lives of many people. Elizabeth Lee reports from Los Angeles, where experts have met to discuss this problem.
More people in the developing world are getting smartphones, and this technology is making a difference, not just in people's lives, but in making government more efficient, says Kenyan official Joe Maturo.
You know, we have got huge fights in terms of corruption, transparency, openness, and technology is really the vehicle we're using to ensure that, you know, whatever transactions are taking place, you can see them, they're digital.
But there are still parts of the world that are not connected.
Obviously, we look at Africa, we look at Southeast Asia, and there are large swaths, obviously, of the population that are not connected.
Once people start using smartphones, they talk less and use more data, making high-speed service a necessity, says Dennis O'Brien of the mobile phone company Digicel. But building the infrastructure is a challenge.
Everybody's built the easy bit. In other words, they've done the towns and the cities. But going into rural communities, they haven't done it because the business case is very thin.
Experts say the private and public sectors need to come together to bring the internet to remote and developing regions and drive economic growth.
Any country that wants to create investment and be a location for investment to create employment, the first thing you need is broadband.
Yet to those who see technology as solving everything, Professor Kentaro Toyama notes, America's social problems did not end when digital innovation began decades ago.
During that same span of time, this country has experienced rising inequality, the median income has declined.
So a smartphone alone won't help pull people out of poverty, adds Toyama.
And if they do have a mobile phone, are people, for example, who are, you know, physical laborers on farms, where it doesn't make too much of a difference if you can have access to the latest agronomic research paper as a way to, you know, improve your farming.
But O'Brien says the opposite is true.
Once you get broadband, you know, you can educate people. you can create jobs for people, and people from an agricultural point of view become much more efficient.
The fact that maybe some of the people in the West haven't come out of poverty because they have not used their devices well is not the same for Africa.
Cisco's Hilton Romanski says it will take cooperation to maximize technology's benefits.
It's going to take, again, all the parties coming together to drive the right cultural shift and the right education into these countries.
The experts agree positive change can happen if education on technology is combined with the right policies in place. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
It's 25 minutes past the hour. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Tunisian clubs Stade Gabesian and Esperance were eliminated from the Orange Africa Confederations Cup at home. Both succumbed to away goal rules after they tied on aggregate with their opponents. Stade Gabesian edged TP Mazembe 2-1 in Gabes, some 410 kilometers south of the capital, Tunis. TP Mazembe advanced, having won the opening leg 1-0. In Tunis, Esperance and Algeria's Mouloudia Olympic Bejaia drew 1-1. The visitors advanced as Esperance held them to a scoreless draw in the first leg in Algiers. Meanwhile, today, Wednesday, Ghana's Medeama are at home to South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns. Morocco's Kwakab Marrakech hosts Sudan's El Merrekh in Marrakech. Angola's Sagrada Esperanca welcome Tanzania's Young Africans to Lukapa in Lunda Notre province, some 830 kilometers east of the Angolan capital, Luanda. Gabon's CF Munana hosts Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel in the capital, Libreville. Egypt's Misri Makassa welcome Libya's El Ahli Tripoli in Fayoum, some 65 kilometers southwest of the Egyptian capital Cairo, while Morocco's FUS Rabat are at home to Mali's Stade Malien in the capital Rabat. Elsewhere, Uganda is disqualified from the Africa Under-20 Championships for fielding an ineligible player in their qualifier against Rwanda, the Confederation of African Football disclosed in Cairo, Egypt. Consequently, Rwanda progressed to play Egypt in the second round. In rugby, hosts Rwanda play Burundi, then Lesotho face the Democratic Republic of Congo in the Africa Division D Rugby Cup in Kigali, Rwanda today, Wednesday. The winner of the four-way contest will gain promotion to Division C, where they will join Cameroon, Mauritius, Morocco, and Nigeria. In table tennis, over 120 players from 16 countries have converged at the Teslim Balogun Stadium in Lagos, Nigeria, for the ITTF World Lotto Nigeria Open Championships. The five-day contest features men and women from Cameroon, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Republic of Congo, Egypt, Finland, Ghana, Hungary, Iran, Mexico, Morocco, Portugal, Romania, Russia, Slovenia, Tunisia, and Nigeria. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Nigerian labor union and civil society groups were still planning to go ahead with a strike today, Wednesday, over increased gasoline prices, despite a court-issued injunction against such action. The country's National Labor Congress and the Trade Union Congress, which say they represent 6.5 million workers, and some civic organizations called for the strike to protest a 70% increase in gasoline prices, prompted by the removal of a government subsidy on gas as well as shortages of foreign currency. Talks with the government to avert the strike were ongoing, but no progress had been reported. Abiodun Aremu, Secretary General of the Labor and Civil Society Coalition, said the government must pull back the price increases before an agreement can be reached. That is it for this Wednesday, May 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ullman, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Butte saying have a lovely day, Africa.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. VOA. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss whether there's a need for a fundamental change in U.S.-Africa relations. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they discuss U.S.-Africa relations next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.